From coast to coast to coast, you're listening to Terra Informa.
Welcome back to Terra Informa. I'm Trevor Chow Fraser.
And I'm Chris Chang-In Phillips.
And we'll be your hosts for the next half hour of environmental news from around Canada and across the world.
Hey, Trevor, did you know this week is a really special week for geeks?
Well, why is that, Chris?
Because this week, you could go up to any Star Wars fan and say, "May the Fourth be with you."
Ugh.
That is a totally relevant joke, because this week, we're talking about the energy that runs our lives. First up, what the frack do we know? We cut through the fumes and answer some of your burning questions about the growing trend of fracking for oil and gas.
Then, what do we mean when we say that Alberta has a deregulated electricity market? We give you a jolt of clarity in this week's Ecobabble.
After that, Our Horizon's Rob Shirky tells us about his plan for a unique type of warning label to reveal some of the hidden costs behind our energy.
Stick with us, and we'll take you on a backstage tour behind the scenes of three big energy issues in Canada. For some, it's the dirty energy with the dirty-sounding name. For others, it's a revolutionary new way to provide clean energy. We're talking about fracking.
Yes, fracking. You probably feel you belong in one camp or the other.
But why? How well do you know the actual risks and benefits of fracking?
Trevor here, and Terra Informa's Danielle Dolgoy, realized they didn't even know exactly what fracking is. So they've been doing research and talking with experts who do know. Experts who know what fracking is and know what we should be worried about. For Terra Informa, here's Trevor and Danielle with What the Frack Do We Know?
So tell me, what do you know about fracking? What's fracking? And where does the name fracking come from? What do you know about the process of fracking? And do you know where the name fracking comes from?
No idea. As it turns out, many people don't have a clear idea of what fracking is. Danielle here has been hitting the streets to ask people these basic questions about fracking, gauging people's general awareness of the practice, and taking people's temperature on whether or not it's something they'd like to know more about. And she's heard a whole range of answers.
I have heard the term. I cannot recollect what it referred to, though.
I know that it's a technique for drilling or separating oil. And that's pretty much it.
It sounds like it's something over the internet, and it sounds like hacking to me. I have no idea.
I know that there's some sort of controversy around if it's, I don't know if it's sustainable or if it's environmentally friendly. So I know that there's a little bit of controversy around fracking.
Well, he's got one thing right. Fracking is controversial. And that's why we want to help with the effort to get an informed and educated debate going. After gauging the public's understanding of the issue, we've come up with three big questions it seems like people want answered. To that end, we spoke with several experts on fracking issues, who we will introduce in a moment. So, Trevor, let's dive right in.
The first big question. Just what exactly is this process called fracking?
They take a lot of water, sand, and these chemicals and pump them into the earth and use that to force oil and natural gas through shale, which is a pretty porous substance, and it rises up and they can either pump the oil out of the ground or just accept the natural gas as it rises up.
Fracking is short for hydraulic fracturing. It's a process for extracting natural gas. There are similar processes for extracting bitumen and oil, but these days, when people talk about fracking, they're referring to the process of natural gas extraction.
How does it work? First, you drill a special kind of well. You drill straight down, and when you reach a certain point, you turn the drilling sideways and start to dig horizontally across a field of shale. Here's Avner Van Ghosh, a major international expert on fracking at Duke University.
You are drilling about 3-4 kilometers in depth vertically, and then you go horizontally another kilometer or 2 kilometers, and you induce very high pressure, 1,000 times the surface pressure, and you're actually bombarding the subsurface. So it's just a measure of thousands of explosion.
This high pressure cracks open the rock, which is generally shale. You know, that flaky kind of rock you sometimes find in gardens? Natural gas trapped in between those layers is then released. To create this high pressure, a fluid needs to be injected into the well. This fluid can be over 99% water, but there are other things in there too. Here's Daniel Alessi, a geochemical expert at the University of Alberta.
Okay, so the process is that you put the water down the well at high pressures, right? It's mixed with several things, so the biocides, which prevent the growth of microbes, which, you know, biofouling is a big issue. There's proppants, which are physical material, sort of grains that hold the fractures open once they're created so that you get continued release of the gas from the shales. And a slew of other things like corrosion inhibitors. So you have something like, you know, certainly hundreds of chemicals typically used in the fracturing process.
So this fracking fluid is injected into the shale formation deep underground. The pressure cracks open the pores of the rock. Then the pressure is released. But to keep the cracks from sealing shut again, proppants in the fracking fluid, basically sand or ceramic beads, hold the pores open. Then the gas is pumped back to the surface along with the fracking fluid.
Not all of the fracking fluid comes back, though. And not everything that comes back is all that desirable. This is where we start to run into some of the big environmental concerns about fracking. That's our second big question. What are the risks of pollution due to fracking? What's fracking?
It's a process to get natural gas. I know that much. And I've seen the videos of people who are in areas where there's heavy fracking and they can actually light their tap water on fire and there's big bursts of it. So I'm guessing it's not that great for communities and probably not great for the environment either.
Fracking will set your water on fire. This is the most common fear that we heard about fracking. And you know what? It's totally true. According to Avner Van Gosh, natural gas can leak out of the fracking wells, where it ends up in the groundwater aquifer. And if you don't live in the city, well, that's probably where you get your drinking water.
Natural gas can be leaked from shale gas well. And in many parts of the United States, people are living there. The shale gas industry is in literally backyard. And as a result, people can put their water on fire, because the level of methane, the major natural gas, is saturated. People cannot use the water anymore because there is a danger of explosion of the house.
Now, defenders of fracking will say that movies like Gasland are bending the truth. Long before fracking, methane was already naturally present in some people's well water. In fact, Avner Van Gosh confirms that some regions do have naturally occurring methane in the water, in northeastern Pennsylvania, for example. But scientists have also shown that there is a conclusive link between fracking and methane in the drinking water of many other locations.
The main reason for these leaks? Well, it's all part of the intense pressure that fracking exerts on the well casing. Wells are generally fracked a dozen times or more, and over time, this takes a serious toll on the structure. Daniel Alessi.
I think some suspect that most wells leak, right, to some extent. The main problem is that it's the cement job on the well itself. In fracturing, every time you do a fracture, you're putting that casing under pressure. And I had talked to an expert on cement jobs from one of the oil companies in Houston. I forget who it was, but he was sort of the lead from one of the major companies. And he said that every time you do a fracture, you weaken the bond between the casing and the cement by something like 50%. So you can see this is cumulative, right? You do it one time, you've lost half the strength of that bond. Well, if you fracture a well a dozen times, that seal is shot.
As serious as this is, the bigger concern for Daniel Alessi is what happens when the water and fracking fluid come back up the well. Remember, it's a whole slew of chemicals going down into deep underground at high pressure, and
The temperature is somewhat elevated, right? So it's maybe 90, 100, 120 degrees, something like that, Celsius. And so one of the questions is you have the original groundwater, which has its own constituents. That's mixed, as you said, with these organic chemicals, proppants, things like that. And that interacts then with the formation which you're fracturing. Say it's a shale. So that shale has its own solid chemistry. It has exchangeable ions, things like that. And it has its own formation water. So you're mixing all of these things together, which in itself is a very complicated system. But you're doing that at a very high pressure and a very somewhat elevated temperature. And so the question about what geochemical reactions happen when you do this sort of very complicated geochemical experiment is an open question. There could be heavy metals of concern. There could be organometallic species that are forming. The concern there is that if you have an organometallic species, they can be a vector of toxicity, and even at relatively low concentrations.
Because the water deep underground contains a lot of dissolved minerals, it's highly saline. Even minor spills of this water could be harmful to some fish, plants, and other organisms. Then there's this added risk of heavy metals and toxins being added to the mix of water and oil and gas that rises back up. Even small spills at the wellhead could have big consequences. Avner Van Gosh has even found that some of this produced water is dangerously radioactive.
And we found that the water that coming together with the gas is highly radioactive in the Marcellus Basin, natural occurring radioactivity. So when it spills or disposes into the environment, this radioactivity is stuck into the sediment. And you're creating a legacy of radioactivity. And when I'm saying radioactivity, it's really high. It's exceeding what in the U.S. you call low-waste radioactivity disposal site. So you have a special license for this in the United States. And the level we found in stream, in river, when disposal took place for the last couple of years, we found that it's much higher level of radioactivity. So that's another issue.
Radioactive sediment is a big problem because it can easily enter the food chain. And in a few years, we won't be able to eat the fish anymore because they've been poisoned. This is called biomagnification. One way that the fracking industry has approached this problem is to simply re-inject all of the wastewater back deep underground. This, as you can imagine, has its own problems.
We heard from many people who think that fracking causes earthquakes. All of the intense pressure does cause microseismic events, although only in 3 or 4 cases have they been intense enough for humans to feel. When people near fracking wells do feel the ground shake, it's more likely because of deep well injection, which here in Alberta is the most common method used to dispose of fracking wastewater.
Of course, when you hear about all of that water being sent deep underground, never to be seen from again, the more pressing thought might be, well, that's a huge waste of water, isn't it? And for some people, this is a big concern. Alexia Lane, author of On Fracking, is especially concerned about water loss here in Alberta.
The water that is injected into the well with a cocktail of chemicals, and including biocides and proppant, is almost always permanently removed from the hydrologic cycle because it's very challenging to remediate that water with a vast array of chemicals that are present in it. And additionally, because of proprietary information, not all chemicals are known.
Each fracking well can use between 2 and 5 million gallons of water over its lifetime. Fracking fluid can be cleaned up and recycled, but a lot of water is lost during the operation, where it seeps away into the bedrock. Common estimates suggest only a third to less than a half of the water comes back.
Although it's millions of gallons being withdrawn, industry proponents and some experts would say that this is overall a very small portion of the water budget, less than 1%. But Alexia Lane is still worried.
Well, I think you have to consider it in the larger context where we have other stresses as well at the same time on our freshwater resources. So while that is true that it is, relatively speaking, quite a small quantity, what we can assume is that that quantity is only going to increase over time. As are other changes to our hydrology, such as, changes to weather patterns, increase in population density taxes our freshwater resources. And we don't always necessarily have a full grasp on our groundwater resources. I think we have quite an extensive inventory of our surface water resources in Alberta, but groundwater is a different story, although they're catching up with that.
It all begs the question, do we even have to use freshwater? In Alberta, we only use freshwater because regulators have made it so cheap.
Right now, the economics are such that the majority of that water is deep well injected, never to be seen again. Absolutely, yeah. The technology exists. It's a cost thing, right? I mean, we could return any water down back to pure laboratory grade water if we wanted to. It's just a matter of cost and in this case scale, right? We're looking at hundreds of thousands to millions of liters of water.
In other more water scarce places, fracking operators use undrinkable saline water drilled from deep underground. Canadian operators might like you to think that that's what happens in Alberta too. But the truth is, the use of saline water for fracking is minimal. But now we're getting ahead of ourselves, because here's our third big question. What can we do to improve the situation with fracking? So, what is fracking, as from what you know?
I don't know too much about fracking. Occasionally it's mentioned on the local news, in which case, you know, me and my buddies kind of talk about it, discuss it and such, but I really haven't heard too much about it, which is surprising.
Why is that surprising to you?
Given I live in Alberta, you'd figure with the oil industry being here, you'd probably hear a lot more about it.
And that's the crucial point here. There are tons of specific fixes we could talk about, but until the public is engaged and informed, we won't have a real debate on fracking at all.
It's a challenge sometimes to understand what is media sensationalization and what is real. And so hopefully with the information that's becoming more accessible and more available to people, they're arming themselves with information. And that also helps to drive policy forward and helps shape the regulatory structure that exists. So I certainly think that as more people understand what fracking is and understand the issues, there's a stronger push towards doing this in a way that is better for our freshwater resources and, of course, in turn, all of us.
Alexia Lane, as well as Daniel Alessi and Abner Van Ghosh, all shared many ideas for the kinds of policy they would like to see. We don't have time to share them all with you here, but join us online at terrainforma.ca to hear this bonus material that didn't quite make it into the show.
Please do check it out, because if there's one thing I'm taking away from this, it's that getting the regulations right is vital, but it's no easy feat.
For Terra Informa, that's all the frack we know. I'm Trevor Chow Fraser.
And I'm Danielle Dalgoy.
Big thanks to our guests in that segment, Alexia Lane, Daniel Alessi, and Avner Van Ghosh. You're listening to Terra Informa, your source for environmental news across Canada and around the world.
You can hear us online at terrainforma.ca, on iTunes, and on your local community radio station, like UMFM in Winnipeg on 101.5 FM. Tell your local station if you'd like to hear us in your community, or email us at terra@cgsr.com.
Diversity.
The United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change.
Uranium.
The Enhanced Oil Recovery.
Sustainable Energy.
Ecobabble.
The proliferation of natural gas fracking in the province affects how we generate electricity here. When you hear Alberta politicians talk about the province's electrical grid, one thing they're fond of trumpeting is Alberta's deregulated electricity market.
If you're like me, you probably wonder what they mean when they say our electricity market is deregulated. Does that mean no one is watching what happens at power plants? Well, fortunately, that's not what they're talking about at all.
To find out what it does mean, on this week's Ecobabble, Trevor and I talked to Gordon Howell, a solar engineer in Edmonton. He works in designing solar electric systems with Howell Mayhew Engineering. And when we ran into him at the Zero 2014 conference, Gordon had a lot to say about deregulation.
So in Alberta's electricity market, anybody can set up an electricity generator. It's up to them to do their economic analysis and decide what they want to do. So there's nobody coming to them and saying, you can or you can't or you should. Whereas before, it was highly regulated for the generators. And so there's still regulations. But before, if somebody wanted to put up a generator, then the Energy and Utilities Board would say, well, look, we don't need it. We don't need the electricity, so no, you can't do it. But now, oh, you do whatever you want, which is fascinating because there's also then nobody saying, hey, we're running out of electrical energy generating capacity. You need to build a generating plant. And that's caused a few issues in the last little while. So it'll go from 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 cents a kilowatt hour or whatever to up to 50 cents to a dollar real fast when a plant crashes. And it doesn't crash that often, thank goodness, of course, and the price doesn't go up that often, but it can.
What's different about Alberta's...
So everybody can generate electricity and they do it. Whereas before that, if I wanted to generate electricity in my house, well, what, I would have had to go through a hearing and say, well, I want you to give me permission to do that. So we are the most open electricity market in the country.
What specifically about this market structure makes it worthwhile working in Alberta for your company?
I was born here. This is where I'm planted. I want to see solar have some winds here.
Thanks so much, Gordon. Appreciate it.
Thanks to Gordon Howell for talking to us about Alberta's deregulated electricity market this week. To find out more about how deregulation affects the cost of power in the province, head to our website, terrainforma.ca.
Here's something I bet you didn't know. The creator of those graphic warning labels on cigarette packages, a man named Oral Muse, wanted to make sure his name was on his art. So Oral Muse made sure the series included an oral cancer warning. Charming, hey? Our next guest, Rob Shirky, is the founder of Toronto-based advocacy group Our Horizon. He wants to make an impact along very similar lines, but on the way we think about energy.
We have some mock-ups that we've styled that sort of look like those on cigarette packaging, and they say something to the effect, you know, warning, use of this fuel product contributes to climate change, which may cause, and then we have a whole bunch, species extinction or ocean acidification, drought and famine. There's really, and that's sort of the sad part with climate change, there's really a lot of options for warning labels.
Rob Shirky is trying to convince municipalities all around Canada to try this idea out, putting climate change warning labels on gas pumps.
We want cities and towns to use their licensing powers to require gasoline retailers to place warning labels on their gas pump nozzles, just like we do with cigarette packaging. And you can even have hyper-local ones. Like I know in Toronto, there is a greater likelihood of catching Lyme disease from ticks as their range is expanding due to climate change. And then you could have something like, say, the mountain pine beetle out in BC.
I know what you're thinking. Is that even legal? But trust him, he's a lawyer. And when his grandfather passed away, Rob took his advice and left his practice to chase this idea.
I put it on the back burner just because I mostly got busy with work and a few other reasons. And then when my grandfather passed away, his last words to me were, do what you love. And then it was about 2 months later, I get this check and I thought, wow, you know what? I have to use this for what really concerns me, right?
Of course, there aren't the same alternatives to gasoline as there is for, say, plastic bags. But Our Horizon's focus isn't exactly changing your individual decision about whether to carry your groceries home by Volkswagen or by bike.
Well, so the first thing we want these labels to achieve is just to shake us out of our sense of complacency. The reality is we do need to transition off fossil fuels. And as long as, you know, car is king and it is a significant contributor to climate change, we're not going to question this. What this does is when someone's holding it in their hand, they're pumping up their car full of gas, they see the warning label, all of a sudden they're at this point where they say, okay, you know what, I still need to get from A to B, but if not this, then what? So what that does is it creates this space then. It creates this space for just in asking the question, for businesses to come in with solutions like that really light, ultra-fuel-efficient vehicle that's always a prototype but never actually gets produced. Or maybe it could be on the political side of thing, I know here in the city of Toronto and in other large urban centers in Canada, we often talk about funding public transit, but it's hard to convince people to invest in public transit. If we had something like these warning labels in place, I think it could shift the population to this point where we might then be more open to those sorts of solutions.
And this is sort of by definition a bit of an untested idea, huh? It's a sort of personal ask to convince someone that smoking might endanger their health, but to make someone sort of make all these cognitive links between big policy questions and then their gas pump, that hasn't been tried before.
No, it's true. And so this actually is globally unprecedented. This is one of these, you know, rare moments in history where a community in Canada will get to pass a law that creates a global precedent.
I have to be honest, this idea makes me kind of sad. I just think, like, how exciting the future could be, you know, with renewable power infrastructure sprinkled everywhere and people having sort of an appreciation for the land that they live on. And the analogy to, like, this cancerous thing and making us have this, like, moral question when we go to the gas pump, like, do we really need to guilt people into welcoming an exciting new future?
Well, isn't that interesting? And I sort of feel the same way. It's funny. I say, yeah, these labels do make me feel sad. And in my own personal life, it's a recognition of what's at stake and the dangers, you know, if we fail to act on this. That leads me to, you know, I ride my bike. It's 7 kilometers to work. I get to do that in the summer. In the winter, I take public transit. I do own a vehicle. It's a small, fuel-efficient car, and I might drive it maybe once a week or once every other week. But I sort of prioritize in that order. And I make those decisions because I recognize what's at stake with this issue. And so I think you do need, it's that push and that pull, you do need that compelling vision for a bright future of where we want to head. But you also need to take that honest look, you know, if we fail to do this, where do we end up?
Last year, Rob had plans to run for city council himself in Toronto. He says focusing on Our Horizon and the gas pump campaign was kind of a strategic move.
And if somewhere along the line it occurred to me, what's a better use of your time, Rob, knocking on doors, you know, fingers crossed to get into council and trying to affect change in Toronto, or coming up with ideas, researching them thoroughly, and then empowering communities across Canada with these solutions. And I sort of thought, you know what, I'm kind of putting my eggs in 4,000 baskets. There's about 4,000 municipalities in Canada as opposed to one. So it just seemed like the smarter bet.
Thanks so much for talking to me, Rob. I really appreciate it.
Chris, thanks a lot for having me on your program.
That was Rob Shirky, founder of Our Horizon. We've got a link to pictures of his group's climate change warning labels on our website. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks to this week's contributors, Trevor Chow Fraser, that's me, Daniel Dolgoy, and Chris Changan Phillips.
Hey, that's me. Thanks also to Tasmi and Ishat for taking care of our website. This week's episode was coordinated by me and produced by Trevor. Terra Informa is a production of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton. CJSR just won Edmonton's John Poole Award for Promotion of the Arts, and an artist that we've featured on Terra Informa, Sierra Jamerson from last year's show Between the Devil and the Deep Blue Sea, she has a CD release party on May 8th for her new album Blood in the Waters, so check it out. And tell us about your favorite new bands and help us give them a little love. We've been your hosts, Chris Changan Phillips
and Trevor Chow Fraser. Catch you next week.